London has always been an international city, be it because of refugees and travellers going there or the requirements of trade. The needs of the great port on the banks of the Thames has seen it since its incarnation as Lundenwick, all the way back in, say, chapter 4 of this podcast, being a place where foreigners and the affairs of foreign nations played a big role in the city's development. This chapter is one where, alas, we need to focus on matters economic and diplomatic for a large part. I say alas because, let's be honest, economic history is not always exciting as wars or grand tales of adventure, but this is important. Regular listeners know my motto, follow the money. If you follow the economic patterns, you will find that cash drives politics, and politics drives history. And in this episode, we'll be looking at what was going on economically in London and why this would become really significant going forward in the story. We also need to talk about the Crusades. There is a reason for this, which I'll explain now straight up. The final crusade in the history of those things was an affair led by an English king, and it was actually more successful and way more glorious than anything Richard the Lionheart ever did. But for reasons that will be explained in due time, this legacy is forgotten about. And yet to understand that, we need to understand that the Crusades as they were ongoing in the story, not least of which being, as mentioned last episode, we have two of the most important nobles in England of this time sailing off to the Far East in our account of things. So that's what this episode is going to be going on about. Hi, my name is Saul, and this is the story of London, the attempt to fashion a somewhat detailed narrative account of the affairs and history of the City of London. It cannot hope to fit in everything, but it does try to cram in as much as possible into the episodes, and we have, much to my surprise, reached episode 90 of the story. Never actually thought we'd get this far. This is an episode about the Crusades and the wars in the Middle East, and also a discussion about macroeconomics and its impact upon the streets of England, which unfortunately sounds about as dry as the Sahara Desert. Hopefully I'll keep it interesting. Welcome then to chapter 90 of The Story of London, The Shine of Foreign Silver. When we last looked at what was going on with the Crusades, the story had gotten as far as the Fourth Crusade, or the Whoops, There Goes Byzantium Crusade. Basically, the papacy didn't run that particular crusade, Venice did, and to cover the costs for underwriting and transporting all the crusaders to the Middle East, Venice had effectively said, "Hey, crusaders, can you do us a little favour and take Constantinople for us? Cheers." And so they did. And the situation is, as we're taking the story up from there, the Crusader states of Outremer are small slivers of land on the coast of the Mediterranean, nominally led by the Kingdom of Jerusalem that didn't run Jerusalem. It was filled with knightly orders like the Templars and the Knights of St. Lazarus and the Hospitallers, who actually had more power back in Europe, and they were pushing constantly for more crusades, and Byzantium at this point was being run by a bunch of French blokes. With us so far, awesome. Anyway, around the year 1217, Pope Innocent III decided maybe we should have a crusade. The situation in Europe, however, was not optimal for a crusade. To be honest, things were a mess. Over in the Holy Roman Empire, a couple of candidates were fighting to become Holy Roman Emperor, and one of them was assassinated, and then another called Otto became the emperor and promptly went to war with the Pope because of reasons, and therefore he was excommunicated, and yeah, not ideal. Over in France, since 1208, all the crusading fervour was being taken up by the internal Albigensian Crusade, and any energy not being taken up by that was being focused on the French Crusades against the territories of King John of England. Sicily was under the nominal rule of a king. The Spanish kingdoms were all up in their attempt to beat up local Muslims, and England itself, as we covered, was kind of been run by revolutionary councils of barons taking over the country. In truth, no one seemed to want a crusade. Everybody was too busy. But meanwhile in Jerusalem, Queen Isabella I of that kingdom was literally a baby in whose name her father, John of Brienne, was ruling things as regent, and he'd managed to negotiate a truce with the local Muslims. But at the same time, the Crusader states of Antioch were gripped by a civil war, and Regent John realized there would be no way the kingdoms of Outremer could help themselves going forward. And so he contacted the Pope and said, please help, and this is why Innocent III wanted to launch a crusade. And despite these ongoing chaotic conditions in Europe, he got one. But the end result was a hodgepodge of people from all over joined in, including a sizable contingent from Hungary, and the fighting was spread out over a massive area. A crusading force was launched against Muslim forces near Damascus, but there was also fighting in Portugal, as there often is, and also in Egypt. Egypt was chosen as the faction of Muslims who ran Jerusalem were based in Egypt, and it was figured if you put pressure on one point, they'll maybe surrender on another point. And in fact, this Fifth Crusade is mostly remembered for the fighting in Egypt. But that didn't achieve anything. It just saw lots of people die, it weakened the hands of Muslims who wanted negotiations over jihad, and it humiliated the Europeans. Strangely enough, the man who was blamed for this debacle was the new Holy Roman Emperor, Frederick II. Frederick was a genuinely incredible figure from this era. I could speak about him for hours, how his supporters called him the wonder of the world, and how the papacy actually named him the precursor to the Antichrist himself. And he was blamed for the failure of the Fifth Crusade, simply because not only was he the Holy Roman Emperor, but simultaneously, he was the King of Sicily and the King of the Romans, or put simply, he ruled a vast kingdom stretching almost from the coast of Sicily all the way to the borders of Denmark. He had a huge amount of people under his rule. He could, in principle, summon massive armies. And he was supposed to lend his troops to the Fifth Crusade, but didn't, and eventually was excommunicated for not helping the Crusader movement. Now, I could go on, as you can imagine, into incredible detail about the exact precise details of what's going on, but that story would take weeks to tell properly. So simply put, after much misadventure, in 1228, Frederick finally launches his own version of a crusade, the Sixth Crusade. And surprisingly enough, Frederick, he wins. This is one of the truly great, utterly overlooked moments of the story of the Crusades. The incredible success of the Sixth Crusade. The one that reclaimed Jerusalem. Yep, he did. And actually, it actually led to a peace treaty where he negotiated a two-state solution for the Holy Land. No, I'm not kidding. Using diplomacy far more than warfare, Frederick, who spoke decent Arabic, it was claimed, having grown up in Sicily and supposedly played with local Muslim kids as a child, he actually managed to negotiate a long-lasting peace deal for the Christian states. The Christians regained Jerusalem. The walls of Jerusalem had been thrown down by this point due to various pressures within the Muslim lands, which meant that nobody could hold the city against the besieging army. But that didn't matter. The Sixth Crusade just hits differently in all ways. It won. Jerusalem was back in the hands of a Christian king. The Sixth Crusade also had a sizable English contingent in it. And this was led by the Bishop of Exeter and Peter de Roches, the Bishop of Winchester. And this is why he left to go play with Frederick in the Holy Land before coming back. And, well, I covered what he did to England in a previous chapter. There is more to this story than I'm letting on, including the really important, massive geopolitical impact of the greatest attack upon Muslim forces ever, that launched by the Mongols. But effectively, the Sixth Crusade saw a Muslim overlord who was busy trying to bring the region around Damascus to heel agree to hand over Jerusalem and a small sliver of land to it to this Christian emperor in order that he may focus on his Muslim enemies. But this Christian emperor was excommunicated and hated by half the Christians around him because he was excommunicated. And this peace treaty, the Treaty of Jaffa, well, not many people liked it. The knightly orders, like the Templars and the Hospitallers, felt the Treaty of Jaffa betrayed them, so they hated it. Several local Jerusalem-based Christian leaders felt the treaty betrayed them, so they hated it. Nearly every Muslim felt the treaty betrayed them, so they hated it. But guess what? The treaty held. In 1229, Jerusalem was now in Christian hands, and for a decade there was this negotiated peace deal, which ran out in 1239. And the new pope then called for a new crusade to go aid Jerusalem in the wake of this. And this is known to history as the Barons' Crusade. And to explain why I'm telling you all of this at the start of this episode, as I mentioned last, two of the folks involved were Richard, the Earl of Cornwall, the younger brother of King Henry III, and Simon de Montfort, brother-in-law of King Henry III, and the guy who takes out loans while using the king as guarantor without, you know, mentioning this to the king. Now, the Barons' Crusade was, as you can well imagine, a messy, wide-ranging affair. The main force was a bunch of Spanish and French knights who set off from Navarre, and they actually set back the cause of the Kingdom of Jerusalem, because upon landing in the Holy Land, they attacked Gaza, and they were defeated. And in retaliation, Jerusalem was retaken by the Muslims. However, eventually the fleet of crusaders led by the Earl of Cornwall, joined as always by his veteran campaigning uncle, the Earl of Salisbury, finally rolled into the region to lend weight to the crusaders elsewhere, and travelling with him, coming in by a different route, was Simon de Montfort. The so-called Barons' Crusade were actually quite successful in terms of territorial gains. What was going on was, once again, local Muslim forces were divided between power blocks, and simply put, the emir of a power block granted the Christians a bunch of land from another power block's territory as a screw you to his rivals. And by doing this and having peace with the Christians, he could focus on his main enemy, which was other Muslims. This did lead to very strange moments where Muslim garrisons were ordered to hand over their fortified locations to the Crusaders, and then refused, and then the Crusaders didn't have enough people to besiege these fortifications. So Muslims then besieged the Muslims in those towers so they could hand the towers over to Christians. Yeah, it's all very deeply confusing and fraught and complex, and welcome to the Middle East. Eventually this crusade would end and Simon de Montfort would return. And let me just stick a pin in history at this moment. Here we are, and we're just about to enter the last 30 years of the Crusades. And oddly enough, the Christian Kingdom of Jerusalem is still hanging on. It's almost at its largest and most powerful since the aftermath of the initial bloodthirsty First Crusade. Using bluff negotiation and exploiting divisions between Muslim forces, the states of Outremer were territorially stronger than ever. And as I said, in 30 years, the last crusade is going to be led by an English king. Ultimately, the Barons' Crusade was a success, and Simon de Montfort and King Henry III's baby brother, the Earl of Cornwall, could return, freshly minted and forgiven for all their worldly sins. They were crusaders, heroes in their own way, about to impact on the story of England and returning to London. But it was a London that was changing, deeply. And to understand the nature of that change, we need to look at the baseline fundamental reasons why London was changing. We need to follow the money, because a set of economic issues were hitting London, and these were causing issues in the decades leading up to the 1240s and in the decades afterwards. Indeed, the economic issues facing London were to be a driving factor in the politics of London all through this era. And this leads me having to confront a slight issue. I've been telling the history of the city as a narrative tale, explaining events as they happen for the most part. But the following section includes me mentioning events that are about to happen. So, you know, spoilers. And also, this is history. There are no spoilers in history. It's a matter of public record for several centuries what's about to happen. But yeah, basically we need to look ahead a little to show you how the economics of the 13th century drove politics then as now. So let's talk economics. The last time we looked at the economy of London in depth was back in chapter 80, The Dancers in the Dark. Another time, the end of the 12th century, when it came to the fortunes of London merchants, things seemed to be on the up. We had English spice merchants and cloth merchants expanding their remit and wealth. We had emigre communities of London-based merchants in places like Genoa. Things were seemingly improving. However, here we are in the year 1240, and the trade of England and above all London had contracted again, this time apparently to its lowest point ever. That resurgence we'd seen a couple of generations before had been merely a bubble, and now foreign rivals were everything. The question which must be asked, therefore, is why the merchants of London, who seemed poised in 1180 to expand their trade again within the Mediterranean, should find themselves here in the reign of Henry III, with the market share being significantly reduced and failing almost entirely compared to foreign merchants. The evidence of their withdrawing from the markets of the Mediterranean dates from the early 13th century. By 1230, there is no indication that the small community of English merchants and craftsmen was still in Genoa. And simultaneously, Flemish merchants were seemingly driving out English merchants from the markets of northern Spain. Now, the most probable explanation given was this was a knock-on effect of English cloth manufacturers failing to compete with their Flemish rivals. And we know that by 1230, Flemish cloth was actually invading the home market. Henry III was buying imports from the Low Countries that year. And by the 1240s, the merchants of Ypres, for example, were prominent suppliers of the royal wardrobe. So what caused the collapse of the English cloth trade? Standard economic historians will explain that this was due to excessive demands for wages and the weavers' guilds across English towns, which made English cloth prices too expensive to be competitive, and hence the bottom fell out of the market. And then with the failure of the English cloth market, the engine of the nation's economy, the rest of the things built upon this, such as trade in spice, also collapsed. However, a closer reading of the evidence suggests that's not actually accurate. Expensive English cloth still did sell well. In 1254, we know merchants from Lucca in Italy were still buying high-quality Stamford cloth in England, and other English luxury cloths were still appearing in the Mediterranean in the 1260s and 1270s, even if they're not carried by English merchants. So that's not the full explanation. Why English merchants withdrew from the Mediterranean is therefore a lot more complex than the simple failure of English manufacturers to compete with Flemish manufacturers in terms of quality or price. In fact, we have to look at what actually caused significant economic changes in the 12th century were the rise of provincial fairs, and that leading to the penetration of the English domestic market by foreign merchants. These two things, the fairs and the foreigners, meant that London was unable to contain the trade of foreign merchants and therefore lost its previous cornerstone of the city's merchant economy. It had control of the distribution of foreign imports out of the city into the provinces of England. This little monopoly had been London's last trump card, but it seems to have come to an end in this era. And with that ending, Londoners ceased to be the major purchasers of provincial wool and cloth, and also the city could no longer serve as the principal conduit for the kingdom's exports. The loss of these profits, which London merchants had earned, meant simply that London's merchants could no longer accumulate the mercantile capital they needed to finance overseas trade. So what we have here are several domino effects all happening at the same time. And while we're looking at events in the 1240s, this economic contraction was to hit London really hard in the decades to come. Okay, pause for a second. Just to remind folks of the economic history of the city, which I've covered basically in six specific episodes, chapters 5, 20, 31, 52, 68, and 80. Simply put, during the Anglo-Saxon era, built upon a bedrock of trade in slaves and cloth, London had become a major trading emporium, and was possibly responsible for the explosion of the import of staggering amounts of bullion into the islands of Britain. These pan-European trading links, principally out of London, across to the Rhine, down to the Alps, and then into Italy, had lasted despite the deprecations inflicted upon the economy by the Danish invaders and the occupation of England by the Danes. But the Normans' whole-scale looting of England's residual wealth had destroyed this, and therefore London's mercantile interests had gained a monopoly over the internal distribution of foreign goods into the provinces. And that had led to it becoming the money pit of the country, the principal financial market of the land. And this was what was contracting, and this contraction was a huge one. It's significant that the sheriffs were experiencing severe difficulties in paying the tax bill from the 1160s onwards, and that big concession in 1190 of reducing it down to £300, even though that was a political deal, it also undoubtedly reflected the city's financial issues. Despite the expansion of coinage at the end of the 12th century, which regenerated the economy of the towns of England, the success of the Flemings' trade with regional fairs meant that a significant part of the distribution of goods being now redirected away from London to eastern ports. And it would be many decades before London could recover its former commercial dominance. It seems that because of these changes, many Londoners found themselves excluded from much of the distribution of trade by the beginning of the 13th century, and they were largely confined now to their regional market. Over the next few chapters, London's going to lose its dominance over overseas trade, and we can see evidence of this as early as 1203 and 1204. Back then, if you look at King John's taxation of foreign merchandise, these show that London still paid the highest amount of tax, 16.8% of the total. But its share was almost equaled by the port of Boston in Lincolnshire at 15.7% and Southampton on the south coast at 14.3%. And little ports like Lincoln and Lille were not far behind them at 13% roughly. The capture by these little ports of a trade which was valued almost the same as London's can be explained away because these ports were near the great fairs and the best areas of producing wool and wheat. Foreign merchants used these fairs to penetrate the provincial economy. And that's what many modern residents of England don't understand. For most of us, if you live in any of a score of towns and cities across England, you'll be aware of the arrival of fun fairs every year and the sounds of bright lights as the fair begins in your town. They're beloved of young people, but we forget once how these fairs were the major economic drivers of the English economy, bringing goods from miles around together with goods from foreign nations and bypassing the normal restrictions of trade in any given town. They became hugely popular and significant. And as we can clearly see here and now, they were breaking apart London's monopoly on foreign trade. It's likely that part of the reason for this is the Flemings were ideally placed to get their hands on increased amounts of German bullion, which they would then bring to buy English goods and purchase wool in particular. See, this gave them a huge advantage, particularly when there was a shortage of bullion in England, like after the First Barons' War. English merchants needed credit to buy large amounts of wool. Flemish merchants were paying hard silver. Who would you do business with? By the time new supplies of silver became available, the structure of English economy had almost certainly undergone a radical change, and wool had overtaken cloth as the country's chief export. In the 1170s, silver was flowing in increased quantities through the mints of Bury and Ipswich, and although there are no definite figures, it becomes clear that English wool had become essential to the economy of Flanders. The export of wool and also corn through the eastern ports was enriching local landlords, provincial wool dealers, and the peasants who owned sheep. And by the middle of the 13th century, the amount of silver in circulation was five times greater than it had been in the 1190. And this gave increased purchasing power to English customers, who now had a greater choice between local and imported cloth, and Flemish cloth was attractive by reason of novelty, price and quality. And even if these provincial fairs had passed their peak by 1220, they remained essential to the commercial strategy of the Flemings, as they had a supreme advantage of being free from all the restrictions of trade which the towns imposed on them. It seems likely, too, that German merchants visiting the eastern ports were doing this more than visiting London in the 13th century, because the fairs gave them the widest outlets for their goods and provided them with exports in return. Much of the wealth generated by export trade in wool was, it seems, bypassing London, and could not then be accessed and invested by London merchants. Londoners were no longer amongst the great capitalists and moneylenders of the land, and their place was taken by the Jews of the towns such as York, Oxford, Norwich and Lincoln, who were enriched by the wool trade. Merchants from Flanders and Provence were selling English cloth in Genoa in the early 13th century. Londoners had neither the capital nor the exports to enable to retain their footing in Genoa or northern Spain, as I explained earlier. Meanwhile, the new supplies of German silver had attracted Mediterranean merchants northward as demand increased for luxury products. The wealth which was generated by the wool trade in this way both helped undermine the English cloth industry and also brought more foreigners to England to sell luxury goods. With me so far, I hope so. Strive though they could, London found it hard to enforce and maintain their hard-won trading privileges. And simply put, London could no longer control the distribution of foreign trade into the kingdom from its ports. And you want proof? Well, look at the changing terms under which the woad merchants of Picardy traded with London. In the 12th century, the citizens of the city had been able to force the woad merchants of Picardy to sell their woad to them directly from their ships. They were not allowed to store their goods in the city or take them from there to any regional fairs. Brilliant! By 1237, however, the Londoners had to give up these restrictions or risk losing the woad trade altogether. They had to allow the merchants from Picardy use the city as their headquarters, that they could allow them to store their woad there, and they allowed them to take it to fairs at Boston, St. Ives and Winchester. In the previous century, Henry II and Richard I had forced Londoners to make similar concessions to the merchants of St. Honor and Cologne. In effect, the citizens had to surrender much of their control over distribution of trade to foreign rivals. The Londoners' failure to limit competition of foreign merchants became more obvious from the beginning of the 13th century, when the merchants from southern France appeared as their rivals. Remember, England controlled Gascony. And from Bordeaux, the wine fleets brought in their wake merchants from Montpellier and Cahors. Now, some merchants from Montpellier appear in the St. Paul's records of the early 12th century, but it was not until the wool trade expanded with the new supplies of silver at the beginning of the 13th century that they and the Cahorsins are attracted in any large numbers to England. I mentioned and talked about the Cahorsins last chapter, and why their name became linked to the practice of usury. Ultimately, Cahorsin was used indiscriminately to describe all merchants from southern France and northern Italy. It originally meant a merchant from Cahors. The Cahorsins first came to England probably as importers of wine from Bordeaux, and also then as servants of the crown in the Gascony campaign in 1225. In the 1220s, several of them were granted licenses to import their merchandise, and the Tolisans, a mercantile family apparently from Toulouse, established themselves on the east bank of the River Walbrook. By the following decade, Cahorsins were exporting wool from many parts of England and had the funds to become the lenders of money to church authorities. In 1242, the king is ordering silk, fine cloth and gingerbread directly from Montpellier, and the following year, two prominent Cahorsins, Arnald Beraud and Arnald Gerardon, were given royal liveries. It is from this point that they become rivals to the London suppliers of peppers and spice, over access to the royal market, which was the most valuable part of the spice trade. The Khorasan's hold over this royal market was immeasurably strengthened when Enald Gerudun was appointed the King's Chamberlain for London and Sandwich, a position he held from 1246 to 1253. It enabled him to favour his compatriots as suppliers of spices and other luxuries to the royal household. And after that, another Khorasan called Pontius Mora was appointed to the same post. And if you can remember back when I last talked about this, and I mentioned somebody called Edward Blund, who'd been effectively the head of the adulterine London Pepperers Guild, Gerudun and Pontius Mora were the Khorasan's version of Edward Blund. From 1249, they figure prominently as suppliers of hundreds of pounds worth of spices, fruit, and silk cloth to the king. Soon, the Khorasans were joined as importers by the merchants of northern Spain, and the Spanish merchants began arriving in London, bringing wax, leather, furs, silks, fruit, and spices such as figs, raisins, almonds, cumin, licorice, and above all, saffron. In 1248, Henry III paid over £150 to three Spanish merchants for wax and other wares. By the second half of the century, Spanish merchants began to establish themselves in London, where they specialised particularly in the leather trade. On all sides, therefore, the London Echevins found themselves hemmed in by foreign competition, forced out of the export trade in cloth to southern Europe, and denied any significant part of the wool trade. Slowly, but with absolute certainty, they had to surrender the import trade in spices to their Mediterranean and Flemish rivals, and the financial benefits that came from this, including capital to fund mercantile or other projects, also sank. It's significant that one of the few Londoners who did sell considerable amount of spices to the royal wardrobe at the provincial fairs in the middle of the century was a man called John Adrian, and he was not a pepperer, he was a draper. In 1250, he and a partner were paid over £54 for dates, gingerbread, cinnamon, and other spices, which were bought for them at various fairs in England. Since Adrian was a draper, it's most likely that his chief interest was in selling Flemish cloth, and that the spices he got were imported by the Flemings to him. So here is a guy who's still making it, but he made it by getting in with the new foreign merchants. And the royal court was playing a significant role still in all of this. The continued importance of the London spice market to the court and the aristocracy in this period is emphasised by the growth in numbers and prosperity of this new group of spices, who formed a separate community or spicery over in Westcheap or Cheapside. This was quite distinct from the traditional group of pepperers who I'd mentioned in previous chapters, who were over in Soper's Lane. Now, we can't be sure when the spicery in Cheapside began. The first reference to it is 1278, but it's quite likely to have developed as a consequence of Henry III's grant of land to his personal spicer, Josias, who was most likely a Jew. In 1227, when the king was still a minor, the king granted Josias an annual rent of about 20 shillings and a plot of land in Bread Street, upon which he built a house. He continued to supply the king with spices until he was succeeded in the 1230s by Richard Durkin, who had a shop in the shambles of Eastcheap, the old spice merchants of London. But then in 1244, another London spicer from the parish of St. Mary Le Bow in Westcheap, Ralph Atterbo de Acubus, had risen to prominence as sheriff, while other spices also settled in and around Cheapside in Honey Lane. By the middle of the 13th century, the two most prominent spice merchants from this quarter of London were Bartholomew, the son of Josias, and another foreigner called Robert de Montpellier. Both of them prospered conspicuously from their royal connections. Robert de Montpellier was probably appointed spicer to Henry III when the king just goes to Gascony, which he's about to do in a bit. And by 1246, he was acquiring shops in Westcheap. And in the course of the next 30 years, he added considerably to his property portfolio in that neighbourhood. And in 1261, Robert de Montpellier became a sheriff of London. Bartholomew, the son of Josias, also grew his property portfolio. Ultimately, what we're seeing here is the rise in Cheapside of foreign-linked merchants, and of English merchants were still doing well in London, but only doing well by tying in with the foreigners. Is somebody going to try and save the city? Well, unfortunately for the native-born Londoners, Henry III showed no loyalty towards the city's commercial interests. On the contrary, he appeared to see his largest city chiefly as a source of cash which needed no protection. And let's be honest, given London's role in the wars against his father, given that London had basically paid for Prince Louis to try and take the throne of England, who could blame him? London had not just sided against the crown. It could be argued they'd instigated the rebellions against the king's father in the first place. So to the king, if the city of London was not doing well compared to very loyal tax-paying foreign merchants, why should he be bothered? His own taste for splendid living and the cost of military expeditions demanded a higher income than he could raise from normal taxation. London, therefore, was called upon in 1226 to double its usual fixed amount. When the city proved reticent, the king brought pressure to bear on it by suspending its liberties, and relations between the king and Londoners hardened during the remainder of his long reign into one of mutual suspicion and outright hostility. And this is what's to come. The more the city of London resists the king's unreasonable demands, the more Henry increases them. He will suspend London's liberties and the position of mayor and take over London government at least 10 times between 1239 and 1257. The following year after that, he charges the aldermen of the city with fraud and dismisses them. And in their place were elected several royal supporters, chiefly men who supplied the court with cloth and wine. Amongst them was the draper, John Adrian, and a spice merchant called Richard de Walbrook. And they kind of formed a royalist party within city politics, led by a vintner called John de Guisors. Like them, he was a court purveyor who supplied the wardrobe with large amounts of pepper, ginger, and other spices. And in 1261, thanks to his adherence to the royalist party, him and John Adrian were elected sheriffs and followed into office by Robert de Montpellier. This is a political faction within London. A pro-Henry III political faction based upon a bunch of guys seeing which way the wind was blowing. And that wind was saying that based on economic conditions, London's old powers were on their way out. The city was becoming, at least economically, increasingly dominated by foreigners. Said foreigners seem to be beyond any native Londoner's power to control. I mean, last episode we saw how London's bishop had tried to exile the Corrosins from the city, but not only had he failed in that, the Corrosins like Earl Gerald and Pontius Mora ended up becoming men of power and responsibility within the royal court. You can gaze at the balance of power in London during the year to come, simply by looking at the hundreds of pounds paid to Corrosin merchants by the kings for silks and spices in the 1240s and 50s, compared to the less than a dozen shillings worth of spices bought from the London pepperer William Grapefig in 1250. William Grapefig does become sheriff in 1250, and his appointment does suggest that what London's politics was going to be like, because you've got him, but then you've also got the likes of Robert de Montpellier, John Adrian and Richard de Walbrook, and it does seem to be a split between those who were getting power because they were tied into foreign merchants and those who were trying to resist the foreign merchants. And adding to all of this was King Henry III inflicting dirty measures against the city. Like, for example, in only a few years' time, the king will grant permission for there to be two annual fairs to take place over in the grounds of Westminster Abbey. And the more important of the two, St. Edmund's Fair, was to extend to a fortnight each October. And during that fair, all the shops in London were forced to close. The Londoners had to stand and watch as their Corrosin, Spanish and Italian rivals would sell spices in Westminster, not only to the court and the nobility, but to provincial merchants as well. The fair at Westminster, in effect, undermined much of the protection which Londoners' franchise gave them, and it contributed to this dominance by foreigners. All of this, the king's continued heavy taxation, his suspension and abuse of the city's liberties, and the favour he showed to courtesans inevitably alienated the majority of citizens who did not belong to the small circle of favoured court purveyors. Given this, can you imagine the city's feelings about this king? Would you be surprised to find that London, as a polity, would be looking for reform or just simply a change in this? So if someone were to come along, someone powerful, someone charismatic, someone willing to stand up to the king, someone like his brother-in-law, the successful crusader Simon de Montfort, would it be a surprise to you that London would support him fully? Of course not. London is, as this chapter concludes, primed to explode in passion in the support of de Montfort and the other barons. The old passions that had driven the city back during the reign of King John were still there. These passions were growing and it would become bloody. All of these economic conditions were covering the streets of London in a volatile accelerant. And all it took was a single spark, and this entire city could ignite. And guess what? King Henry III was playing with matches. And there I'll leave it. As always, with the economic assessments of what's going on, a bit of a dry episode. I hope you could follow it. I hope you could be entertained with it. I will, in the next episode, be bringing it way back to the practicalities of the streets of London, buildings, people, events, weather, that kind of stuff. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. If you can, support the story of London by making a contribution at our Buy Me a Coffee page. That would be really helpful. A simple contribution can help us pay the fees to keep it hosted and running. But beyond that, all I do genuinely hope for, if you don't feel like doing that, is that you enjoyed it. Thanks for listening. Back again for chapter 91 next week. See ya.